Picture this. You begin your evening shift in the emergency department by meeting an ambulance as it arrives in the trauma bay. Sujata, a middle-aged woman, is brought in after being involved in a motor vehicle accident. The EMT tells you that her blood pressure has been falling over the past 15 minutes, despite initiating intravenous fluids. On brief exam, her blood pressure is 74 over 50, and her heart rate is 120 per minute. Sujata's abdomen is distended and firm, and her extremities are cool. You race to initiate care. What care must you immediately initiate? How would you describe her hemodynamic picture? And why is her blood pressure so low? Welcome to Audio Bricks. I'm Laurel Toft, bringing cardiology from our bricks to your ears. After completing this brick, you will be able to 1. Define shock. 2. Describe the clinical presentations of the different forms of shock. 3. Explain the physiologic parameters measured in shock. 4. Describe the 5 primary types of shock, including how they differ in cardiac output, afterload, and preload status. And 5. Outline the principles of management of shock. Part 1. What is shock? Shock is defined as a state of widespread cellular and tissue hypoxia, which is the failure of cells to get the minimum amount of oxygen to keep them functioning properly. In other words, shock is the lack of adequate oxygen. This can be due to poor oxygen delivery, limited oxygen extraction by the tissues, or both. This oxygen shortage is not immediately fatal, but it can rapidly progress to multi-system organ failure and death if not corrected. The most characteristic and concerning finding of shock is hypotension, defined as systolic blood pressure less than 90 millimeters of mercury, or a mean arterial pressure MAP less than 65 millimeters of mercury. Shock can be subdivided into 5 broad categories: distributive, cardiogenic, hypovolemic, neurogenic, and obstructive. Distributive shock has 3 subcategories: sepsis, anaphylaxis, and adrenal crisis. Similarly, obstructive shock has 2 subcategories: pulmonary obstruction or structural. You can use this definition of shock to remember the 5 types: new cells down and out from hypoxia, N for neurogenic, C for cardiogenic, D for distributive, O for obstructive, and H for hypovolemic. New cells down and out from hypoxia. Let's pause for a quick quiz. Question: what is shock? Shock is widespread tissue hypoxia, often secondary to inadequate delivery of oxygenated blood to the vital organs. Part 2. How does a patient with shock present clinically? Patients with shock usually appear acutely ill and are sometimes unconscious. They almost uniformly have low blood pressure, hypotension. Patients can also have shortness of breath, chest pain, abdominal pain, cool blue or painful fingers and toes, or altered mental state. Sometimes the cause is obvious, like massive GI bleeding, high fever, or burns. But sometimes the reason for the shock is not so apparent. Let's discuss the stages of shock. No matter the underlying trigger or insult for shock, patients often exhibit a similar pattern and progression of symptoms. Starting with that primary hemodynamic insult, patients can then develop compensated shock, then deteriorate into uncompensated shock, and finally, to end organ failure and irreversible shock. Note that these are not obvious stages that are seen in all patients, but they can be useful markers to evaluate the progression of shock. Let's take a closer look at those stages. First, the primary insult. Depending on the type of shock, insults or triggers, we use those words interchangeably, vary and can include trauma, myocardial infarction, sepsis, and anaphylaxis. We'll discuss some of these in detail later, but the key to remember is that the trigger causes a specific hemodynamic insult. Identifying this initial hemodynamic insult is key to understanding the body's compensatory mechanisms in response. Next, let's talk compensated shock. The first stage of actual shock is compensated shock. Here, the body is able to maintain a somewhat normal blood pressure by responding to whatever is triggering the shock. The body tries to find ways to compensate for decreased organ perfusion, such as increasing cardiac output or increasing systemic vascular resistance, all in an attempt to maintain blood pressure. It's important to remember that the body's goal, so to speak, during this stage, is to maintain blood pressure and therefore perfusion at any cost. Signs of systemic stress, such as restlessness or rapid breathing, may be the only indicators of impending deterioration. Then comes uncompensated shock. The next stage of shock is uncompensated shock, during which the compensatory mechanisms fail and the blood pressure falls. Symptoms of severe stress and organ dysfunction begin to surface, such as a decline in urine output and altered consciousness. There may be peripheral vasoconstriction manifested as cyanotic hands and feet. Because of the lack of oxygen, metabolic acidosis develops as more and more cells are forced to switch to anaerobic glycolysis for energy, producing increasing levels of serum lactate. Respiration increases to compensate for this metabolic acidosis. Finally, we get to end organ failure. If rapid action is not taken to reverse the shock, end organ failure can occur. The entire body becomes hypoxic, and metabolic acidosis swiftly leads to end organ failure as the vital organs shut down one after another. Heart rate climbs, mean arterial pressure falls, and respirations increase dramatically as the shock becomes unresponsive to therapy. Urine output drops, electrical activity in the nervous system fades, and the patient loses consciousness. Fingers and toes become cyanotic and mottled due to poor perfusion. Lips and skin exhibit cyanosis. Death follows in short order. Let's take a pause to see if you got all that. What are some signs and symptoms of end-stage shock? Hypotension, tachycardia, tachypnea, sweating, decreased urine output, cyanosis at the extremities, and changes in mental status are all signs and symptoms of end-stage shock. Part 3. What physiologic parameters do we follow in a patient with shock? All types of shock lead to changes in one or more of the following variables: mean arterial pressure, or MAP, cardiac output, systemic vascular resistance, SVR, and arterial oxygen content. The pattern of change will vary with the type of shock. Understanding these concepts is vital to understanding the mechanisms of shock, so let's take some time to review them. First up, mean arterial pressure. MAP is the average arterial pressure during one cardiac cycle, meaning systole and diastole, influenced by cardiac output and systemic vascular resistance. It can be estimated with the following formula: MAP equals diastolic blood pressure plus 1/3 of the difference between systolic and diastolic blood pressure. Or another way of saying it is the diastolic blood pressure plus 1/3 of the pulse pressure. These pressures are routinely measured by using a standard blood pressure cuff or arterial line. Next, cardiac output. Cardiac output is the product of heart rate and stroke volume. Cardiac output equals heart rate times stroke volume. Now, the stroke volume, and therefore the cardiac output, is decreased by decreased preload estimated by the end diastolic volume. It makes sense that if there is less volume in the heart, the stroke volume will be decreased. Stroke volume also decreased by increased afterload determined by the SVR. Afterload is sometimes estimated by the MAP, but remember, that's just a shortcut, and SVR is the true afterload. Finally, decreased stroke volume is caused by decreased myocardial contractility. Next, let's remember systemic vascular resistance. SVR is the total resistance to blood flow and is mainly determined by arteriolar constriction, which is largely regulated by the sympathetic nervous system. To calculate SVR, divide MAP by cardiac output. You can also remember and rearrange this equation. Cardiac output equals MAP times SVR. Lastly, let's discuss arterial oxygen content. Because shock is ultimately caused by failed oxygenation of the blood or failed extraction of oxygen by the tissues, we need to calculate the amount of oxygen delivered to the tissues. This is determined by the cardiac output and the oxygen content in the arterial blood. The equation is oxygen delivery equals cardiac output times arterial oxygen content. Now, the arterial oxygen content, abbreviated large C, depends on the amount of hemoglobin available to bind oxygen, the oxygen saturation of hemoglobin, abbreviated SaO2, and the partial pressure of oxygen dissolved in the blood, abbreviated PaO2. That latter term, the partial pressure of dissolved oxygen, is really small, so the content equation can be simplified as content of oxygen in arterial blood equals hemoglobin times 1.36 times SaO2. C, or arterial oxygen content, and SaO2 are measured in millimeters of mercury. The SaO2 is measured using routine arterial blood glass analysis, and the hemoglobin is measured as part of the complete blood count. Now, arterial oxygen content could fall because of a decreased cardiac output, anemia, or decreased oxygen saturation of arterial blood. Sometimes the oxygen content is measured in both arterial and venous blood, and the difference is calculated. It's called the arteriovenous oxygen difference. This value is sometimes useful diagnostically. For example, in septic shock, the tissues often do not extract much oxygen, making for a small difference between arterial and venous oxygen content, or a small arteriovenous oxygen difference. Quiz time! What physiologic factors determine arterial oxygen delivery to the tissues? Answer is cardiac output, the blood hemoglobin level, and the oxygen content in the arterial blood determine arterial oxygen delivery. Part 4. What are the 5 types of shock? Now, recall those 5 types of shock: distributive, cardiogenic, hypovolemic, neurogenic, and obstructive. Each differs in its primary insult and the compensatory changes. If you learn to define each type in terms of cardiac output, SVR and preload, or end-diastolic volume, EDV, you'll go a long way in understanding how to diagnose and treat these life-threatening conditions. Let's start with distributive shock, with the primary insult of decreased SVR. In distributive shock, there is extensive systemic vasodilation, causing a decrease in SVR and therefore blood pressure. Well, what can cause this vasodilation? Well, there are many causes, including sepsis, when a bacterial infection exposes the immune system to microbial components, including lipopolysaccharide, or LPS, that stimulates the inflammatory cells to produce cytokines like TGF, interleukin-1, or IL-1, interferon gamma, IL-6, IL-12, and IL-18. These cytokines mediate endothelial cell damage and the release of vasodilators such as nitric oxide and prostaglandin I2. Bacterial infection is the most likely to cause sepsis, although other infections can do it as well. Systemic inflammatory response syndrome, or SIRS, can also cause vasodilation. This is a complex inflammatory response to stress that involves the entire body. The criteria to diagnose it include high heart rate, extremes of temperature, high or low, and high or low white blood cell count. Causes can include infections. In fact, SIRS is a stage in the development of sepsis, but can also include non-infectious inflammation due to trauma, pancreatitis, or burns. In SIRS, there is an activation of humoral and cellular immunity, the complement system, and cytokines. Also causing vasodilation is anaphylaxis. This is caused by re-exposure to an antigen against which an individual already has produced specific immunoglobulin E antibodies. This leads to vasodilation through basophil degranulation and release of histamine, prostaglandins, and leukotrienes. And finally, adrenal crisis. This is a major deficiency of cortisol and/or aldosterone, often due to abrupt withdrawal of chronically administered corticosteroid drugs. These hormones are critical in maintaining the SVR, and there may be hypotension or shock when they are profoundly decreased. It's worth repeating here. The primary hemodynamic insult in distributive shock is low SVR due to vasodilation. The low SVR forces the body to compensate by an increase in the cardiac output in an attempt to maintain the MAP. Remember, MAP equals cardiac output times SVR, and the body is trying to maintain that MAP at all costs. The body does this by increasing both heart rate, tachycardia, and stroke volume, each driven in turn by the sympathetic nervous system. The preload in this situation also drops because the inflammatory cytokines cause leaky capillaries and fluid exits the blood vessels and leaks into the extravascular space. So, if you were to define distributive shock by hemodynamic parameters, SVR is down, cardiac output is up, and preload is down. Clinically, the patient will be hypotensive, but the peripheral vasodilation may cause the skin to be warm even at the extremities, which can be cold in other types of shock. Let's see if you got all that. Question: what happens to MAP during distributive shock and why? Answer is, The MAP will be low during distributive shock because of vasodilation, which causes the decreased SVR. Next up, cardiogenic shock with the primary insult of decreased cardiac output. In cardiogenic shock, blood pressure drops because the heart fails to pump blood through the circulatory system. In other words, decreased cardiac output. Some of the causes can include myocardial infarction, cardiomyopathies, valvular disease, and myocarditis. To maintain blood pressure in the face of a low cardiac output, the body must raise the SVR. This arteriolar constriction leads to high afterload in cardiogenic shock. So the SVR is high even though the blood pressure is low, which can be confusing. This is when it's really important to remember that SVR is not the same thing as blood pressure or MAP. Remember, MAP equals cardiac output times SVR. So in order to maintain MAP, in the face of dropping cardiac output, the SVR increases. Clinically, the patient may have tachycardia, dyspnea from pulmonary edema, and an S3 heart sound. The end-diastolic volume, preload, rises due to the inability of the heart to adequately pump the blood forward, which also causes pulmonary edema. So to characterize the hemodynamics of cardiogenic shock, cardiac output is down, SVR is up, and preload is up. Time for an important clinical correlation. How would a clinician treat cardiogenic shock? Well, sometimes an inotropic drug is required to increase cardiac contractility. Although the instinct of many clinicians might be to start vasoconstricting agents for the low blood pressure, this would increase SVR, and what the patient actually needs is a vasodilator to relieve the high SVR and afterload. This will allow the weak heart to pump more easily. Turns out, inotropes are often also vasodilators, which is pretty handy. Treatment will be discussed further in the management of shock BRIC. Quiz time! What are some of the causes of cardiogenic shock? Cardiogenic shock may result from myocardial infarction, cardiomyopathies, valvular disease, and myocarditis. Now, let's move on to hypovolemic shock with the primary insult of decreased preload. Hypovolemic shock is caused by loss of blood or plasma volume, most often by a sudden hemorrhage. It can also result from causes of dehydration, like severe vomiting or diarrhea, overuse of diuretics, or lack of fluid intake. In hypovolemic shock, less volume circulating in blood vessels means lower venous return and therefore reduced preload. The reduced preload leads to reduced stroke volume, which in turn reduces cardiac output. The body's balancing act for hypovolemic shock is to try to compensate by raising the SVR, the afterload, via arteriolar constriction. The body will also attempt to increase the cardiac output by raising the heart rate and contractility, just as it did in distributive shock. However, because of low preload, the overall cardiac output is generally low. So, to characterize hypovolemic shock in terms of hemodynamics, the preload is down, cardiac output is down, and SVR is up. Clinically, this patient usually has cold extremities from vasoconstriction and may appear pale due to the hemorrhage. A source of bleeding like trauma or GI is often obvious. Question. Why does hypovolemic shock result in low cardiac output? Answer is, the low blood volume reduces preload and therefore stroke volume. All right, now for neurogenic shock, where everything is down. Neurogenic shock is caused by a failure of the autonomic nervous system, usually due to traumatic brain or spinal cord injury. In this case, blood pressure profoundly drops. Failure of the autonomic system disrupts everything, preventing the compensatory responses we've seen so far in other types of shock. There is concurrent arterial vasodilation, causing low SVR and low afterload, low heart rate and low contractility, causing low cardiac output, and low venous constriction, causing low end-diastolic volume and preload. Remember, this is the one where everything is down. It's also the only type of shock in which the patient does not have tachycardia, since the sympathetic nervous system cannot mount that response. Some authors place this under the umbrella of distributive shock since the SVR drops, but the cardiac response and the compensatory mechanisms are quite different. Clinically, there will often be neurologic signs and symptoms or a history of trauma to the brain or spinal cord. Question time! What are the compensatory responses in neurogenic shock? None, since the autonomic nervous system is not functioning. And finally, let's end with obstructive shock, where the primary insult is obstruction causing decreased cardiac output. Obstructive shock is caused by a blockage of circulation through the heart. It's a little more complex because there are two subtypes, each of which decreases MAP by a slightly different mechanism. The first type is pulmonary obstructive shock. In this condition, increased resistance to flow within the pulmonary circulation prevents blood from reaching the left side of the heart. This increases right ventricular preload but reduces left ventricular preload, causing systemic cardiac output to drop. The most common example of this is a massive pulmonary embolism. The other type is structural obstructive shock, when the resistance is caused within the heart itself, which is restricted from filling with the necessary amount of blood. This decreases both right and left ventricular preload and cardiac output. Causes include tension pneumothorax, when air in the pleural cavity causes collapse of the lung and high pressure prevents venous return and filling of the heart, and cardiac tamponade, when fluid in the pericardial space around the heart prevents normal cardiac contraction and blood flow. For both types of obstructive shock, cardiac output is down. Afterload is up, and left ventricular preload is down. But pulmonary obstructive shock is tricky to understand because we need to think of preload in the left and right sides of the heart separately. Preload on the right side is up, but preload on the left side is down. In both types of obstructive shock, cardiac output is low because of increased resistance in some parts of the vascular system and poor filling of the left ventricle. The body attempts to compensate by increasing heart rate to try and increase that cardiac output. The SVR, or afterload, increases in response to the low cardiac output. So far, this looks a lot like cardiogenic shock. However, unlike in cardiogenic shock, in obstructive shock, the preload in the left ventricle is decreased because the obstruction prevents venous return. Clinically, the most obvious distinguishing features of obstructive shock are the signs and symptoms of the underlying cause: unilateral leg swelling, dyspnea, pleuritic chest pain when you have a pulmonary embolism, or absent breath sounds in pneumothorax, or distant heart sounds and jugular venous distension in cardiac tamponade. Let's see if you got that. Why is cardiac output low in obstructive shock? Less blood fills the left ventricle during diastole, so cardiac output is reduced. It's really important to be able to compare and distinguish types of shock. Can you identify which type of shock a patient might have from their MAP, SVR, preload, cardiac output, and heart rate? See if you can quiz yourself to identify the primary insult and the compensatory mechanisms for each type of shock. For example, which type of shock has decreased cardiac output as the primary insult, with a compensatory increase in heart rate, increase in SVR, and high preload? If you said cardiogenic shock, you were correct. Now, how do you think shock might affect different systems in the body? The main complications of shock stem from low oxygen delivery to the organs, which leads to a variety of problems. Cardiac problems include arrhythmias, cardiac arrest, and myocardial infarction. Gastrointestinal complications include mesenteric ischemia and necrosis. Even the hematologic system is impacted with disseminated intravascular coagulation. Lungs can develop adult respiratory distress syndrome, which is respiratory failure due to non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema. Kidneys are affected with acute tubular necrosis and kidney failure, resulting in anuria. Musculoskeletal complications include ischemic and necrotic digits, especially the toes. And neurologic sequelae are stroke, ischemic injury, and coma. Part 5. How do we manage shock? The main goal of treatment for shock is the stabilization of the patient and treatment of the underlying disorder. For example, antibiotics for infection, afterload-reducing agents for heart failure, and blood or saline for hemorrhage. Unless the patient has pulmonary edema, an infusion of normal saline is often given to a hypotensive patient to see if they respond. Hypovolemic shock will respond well. If there is no response to saline, the patient will likely need ICU monitoring both for diagnosis and therapy. Keep in mind, this is a practical first step and not because all types of shock need fluid, but rather because it's a very quick first step and can help you determine the treatments that are needed. Rarely, placement of a right heart catheter called a Swan-Ganz or pulmonary artery catheter can determine right atrial and left atrial pressures or preload, determine cardiac output, and allow precise calculation of SVR. Because the catheter is now recognized to have risks and does not necessarily improve mortality, it's used less frequently than before. Drugs and other methods to treat cardiogenic and distributive shock are covered in the BRIC on management of shock, but treatment is always aimed at correcting the primary insult and reversing any deleterious compensatory responses. To summarize, distributive shock is treated with arterial vasoconstrictors called pressors to increase the SVR. Cardiogenic shock is treated with afterload-reducing agents to lower SVR and inotropes to increase cardiac output. Hypovolemic shock is treated with IV fluids or blood to increase preload. Neurogenic shock is treated with saline and vasoconstrictors if needed. Obstructive pulmonary shock due to a pulmonary embolus may be treated with thrombolytic drugs to dissolve the clot. An obstructive structural shock is treated by the withdrawal of pericardial fluid called pericardiocentesis for tamponade, tube thoracostomy for tension pneumothorax, and pericardiectomy for constrictive pericarditis. Now, after all that we've gone over, you might be asking, what outcome can we expect for a patient in shock? Well, shock is a highly critical state. Mortality rates are 25 to 50% for cardiogenic and distributive shock, and lower for some of the other types. And that's it for shock. Thanks for sticking with me. Let's check your knowledge and see what we've learned today. First, can you define shock, and how does it present clinically? Shock is due to widespread cellular and tissue hypoxia that occurs when the supply of oxygen being delivered to cells does not meet their demand, or when there is poor oxygen extraction by the tissues. Presenting signs and symptoms include tachycardia, tachypnea, restlessness, sweating, distress, hypotension, decreased urine output, skin discoloration, and changes in mental status, some of which you may feel like you have after listening to this long BRIC. What are the hemodynamic variables that are altered in all types of shock? All types of shock are caused by an alteration in four key variables: systemic vascular resistance, mean arterial pressure, cardiac output, and arterial oxygen content. What causes distributive shock? Distributive shock is caused by a drop in SVR. Common causes are infection, sepsis, and anaphylaxis. Now, what is the primary insult, and what are some common causes of cardiogenic shock? Cardiogenic shock results from a fall in cardiac output. Common causes include myocardial infarction and cardiomyopathy. What causes hypovolemic shock, both the primary insult and common causes? Hypovolemic shock results from a drop in blood volume and a reduction of preload. Common causes include acute hemorrhage or severe dehydration. Next, what causes neurogenic shock? Neurogenic shock results from autonomic nervous system failure, leading to reductions in cardiac output, SVR, and preload. Causes are severe head or spinal cord trauma. What are the two types of obstructive shock? Obstructive shock is caused by a blockage that prevents the blood from passing through the heart, either due to a pulmonary embolus or a cardiac obstruction such as tamponade, pneumothorax, or constrictive pericarditis. And finally, what is the fundamental principle of treating shock? Treatment of shock depends on the type and the underlying cause, but should be aimed at reversing the primary insult and any deleterious compensatory mechanisms. Whew, and we're done. Armed with your newfound knowledge, let's think back to your patient, Sujata, from the beginning of this episode. If you recall, Sujata is presenting with profound hypotension. What is the cause of her hypotension? How would you describe her hemodynamics? Sujata is in hypovolemic shock due to low cardiac output and stroke volume from blood loss into her abdomen. She is compensating for her low cardiac output by increasing her heart rate. This compensatory increase in heart rate, along with an increased SVR, tries but fails to maintain MAP. Remember, MAP equals cardiac output times SVR. Recognizing that preload must be increased, you accelerate the rate of her intravenous fluids and arrange for a blood transfusion. You consult surgery to manage her hemoperitoneum urgently. Sujata is taken stat to the operating room. Her internal bleeding is controlled, and she makes a successful recovery. And that's our show. If you liked this episode, send us a comment or give us a thumbs up. Until next time!